You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Psycho Vertical Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Kirkpatrick. Another Friday, another afternoon of trying to work out what to talk about. I was supposed to be talking to Pete Whittaker, but he could only do it like 8 o'clock in the morning, so it was too early. 8 o'clock. Like I've been up. I love being up early, but it's just my brain won't work that well at that early in the morning. So I did a post this week on my Substack. If you don't know what Substack is, it's kind of like I'll probably just put it on my website, but it's basically it's a bit like a website, bit like a email kind of service thing, and you basically all the trendy people are on Substack, so you basically put it on Substack. And people can support. It's a much easier way. People like supporting what you do and stuff, and rather than having it on your website and stuff. So anyway, so I got this Substack. It's andykirkpatrick.substack.com. And I generally try and do something every week, because I have people paying supporters. You pay €5 or €5 a month or €50 a year or something. So it's very highly appreciated, people who kind of support that kind of thing. So I always feel like I need to get on it every week. This week I'm trying to put together my show for a start next week. Is it next week? Next weekend in Sheffield and Buxton, and to travel around for a month in the UK. Hopefully the UK stays open. So I'm trying to do that at the moment. So it's always a bit of a nightmare. A lot of comedians, when they're doing tours, they would generally work on the material over a long period, and they would, do small venues. Like I've been to theatres where they'd have, someone who was doing stuff at Wembley Stadium, but they would go and do a week in this tiny little theatre, and I don't know if people paid, but people would come and then they would work through the material. So I don't really have that kind of thing. So generally, it's interesting. In the past, generally when you're on tour, you had already told all these stories so many times that you basically had a good idea about how to structure it all together and things. But I think on this tour's a bit different, because I don't seem to meet so many people and retell stories. So as I was going through the structure of the show, the show's called Mind Your Head. That's one of these things that someone asks you, what's it called? 2 years ago, and you're mind your head, and then the kind of stuck holidays from hell. They don't really go together, the two things, but so you're trying to like structure the whole thing together. And the idea originally was for it to be like non-linear, but cover like about 3 years, and going back between loads of adventures and things. And you would have, you know, like a bit about hire cars, a bit about dealing with like wild animals, you know, all that kind of stuff, crime and punishment, all that kind of stuff, a bit about climbing. And I decided I'm going to start it like every story needs a, you know, a start, a beginning and an end, but they'd have to be in that order. So this kind of starts near the end, where I'm sort of being marched through the airport in Q8, being deported, and so it's got this kind of like oh, what's happening kind of thing, maybe, like Midnight Express, you know, all that kind of stuff. Going to channel some Midnight Express kind of stuff, and my wife's disappeared somewhere, and you know, everyone's freaking out and going crazy, and you know, it's like madness or whatever. And then I go into like Vanessa's deciding to have like 2 years off from work, have like a career break, and going off traveling and all that kind of stuff. So like one thing I'm worried about is I hope if someone's talking about the holidays, people are like, oh, what a wanker, it's like talking about holidays, like I mean I'll leave for like 2 years or something. So hopefully that won't be the case. So I'm going through that at the moment, but it's kind of hard. It's kind of stressful. It's been stressing me out for like a long time, because you're always thinking like, oh God, I've got nothing to talk about. Like, oh Christ. I remember when I came back from Greenland, I have zero to talk about that trip. Like nothing happened. And then like now I have like so many stories like from that trip, like loads of things, which are little things. Like in Greenland, I said that that the women should maybe go on the pill, because, and then they won't have a period. And then if you're on the ice for like a month, it might be a bit better. Like, I don't know where I got this idea from. I don't know anything about stuff and stuff like that. So they did that. But then they both started getting the period anyway, so they didn't have any tampons or whatever. So, yeah, that's a funny story. And, like, in the middle of Greenland, we saw these, like, we somehow managed to bump into some people coming the opposite direction across Greenland, and were skiing towards them. And it turns out it was these four women coming, and you know, the first thing was like, do you have any tampons, and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, so it's kind of interesting how you do I've got loads of stories in this show. I've got a story about being attacked by an elephant, I've got a story about being attacked by a baboon, where I had to sort of try and defend myself, and you know, a gun battle going on, like loads of stuff. But I guess it's kind of funny, really. It's a funny, like most, like one, I had this real, like important moment where I was like, it's not meant to be funny. Like I'm stressing out, cause I'm like, it's not funny. I'm like, and I was like, what are you talking about? It's not meant to be funny. You're not meant to be a comedian. You're just meant to be like telling some stories about, you know, going around places. So that was a good thing to focus on. Is a lot of slideshows are shit, basically, aren't they? Like if you go to them, like basically shit, and you know, or they're just not quite as shit as the other ones you've been to. So as long as it's like not quite as shit as the ones that aren't as shit as the other ones, then you know, then it's like if it's like two shits removed from a shit one, then it might you know, it'd be okay. So I never used to think about it before. I think I used to, like, often I would just turn up and I would have like put the slideshow together the day before, and they'd be like, you know, 500 people in like a theater, and then you would just start doing it. But then I would end up having saying stupid stuff that was getting me into trouble. So that maybe I think you have to be so much more careful these days about saying the wrong thing and upsetting somebody. So that's a bit of a pain. I could see this being like the last time I do this, because I just feel like the world, you know, isn't really, and maybe that's not fair, because like a lot of people, You know, like when I was last time I went on tour, there was a guy who was going around and he had a puppet of Bin Laden, like a suicide bomber. He was going around and he was like selling out of like the same kind of venues. So there is an appetite, and you do kind of forget, like when you're touring around, you know, like Roy Chubby Brown would have been there the week before, or Jethro, or these people who just have no presence on the television. They live in this kind of separate ecosystem of like theaters and traveling around and stuff. So, but I guess they're kind of on borrowed time, because all the people are dying who used to like their kind of humor. So it's you always need to be constantly evolving, I think. Like I know somebody was, he spent his whole life just being a programmer for like an operating system or what, programming soft language that's, you know, like 30 years old or something. Like he was almost like someone who made like Victorian window frames or something, you know, like he was like one of the, you know, there weren't that many people who could do it, and it was great until they stopped using it anymore and he didn't know how to do anything else. So it's kind of important to keep an eye on like where things are going. Like it could be because of the C word, like everything, you know, that whole industry could be like wiped out of like comedians and shows and stuff. And I know Kenton Cool has just done a tour, and I'm doing a tour with the same people, and I think I get the impression it was like tough going, because, you know, Kenton would usually like sell out venues and stuff, and I think I think in some places it's hard getting people to want to go out again. Like I've not been to the cinema or anything myself, so yeah, but there's nothing on, that's why. So maybe June, or maybe that, I don't know. Every time you think a film's going to be good, you can't really trust you can't really trust anyone to if it's any good anymore. So, you know, maybe that don't really bother. So, because I can't get Pete on, I thought what I might do, I might actually read through this latest post on Substack, and as I read through it, maybe I'll talk about some of the things in it. It's like someone asked me a question, and about melting snow, that white stuff that's frozen, comes out of the sky, and I get this like long answer, but it was like a lot of things. As I started writing it, that's the problem with the internet, is that you haven't got, you're not restricted, so sometimes you just end up writing way too much, and I probably could condense it down into about a paragraph, like what I wrote. It was probably about 3,000 words, but I could probably just condense it down, really. But anyway, you might find it interesting. As I'm reading through it, then I'll have some thoughts on this. And so anyway, but usually you can see how many people read, open the thing. So you basically post it on Substack, and then it gets sent to everybody, emailed to everybody, and you can see how many people open it. And usually I get quite a good ratio of people opening things. But this one had a lower ratio, and I think it's because it's got the word Nazi in it. It's like snow melting Nazi. So I think people may be a bit sick of Nazis. So, and who can be sick of Nazis? Anyway, so or Nazis, as some people call them. So maybe that was a mistake. I should have called it something else. So snow melting paedophiles or something. So yeah, so I'll just, so the bit, so this is the question anyway. Good evening, Mr. Kirkpatrick. That's quite very good evening. That's a very interesting. He must be a foreign person, because it's like, you know, salutations. We have found money in our vault. Can we send it to you, Mrs. Kirkpatrick? I have a question regarding the optimal size, in brackets volume, of a cooking pot for melting snow on a multi-day alpine climb, which includes bivvies in a tent or in the open. I always thought the more volume the pot has, the less time the fuel, the less time and fuel you have to use to melt enough snow for drinking and cooking instant food. I also thought that this would outweigh the weighted penalty of the bigger pot, because the more often you have to melt pots full of snow, the less time you have to rest or sleep. Or is melting snow in smaller pots much faster? I'm a bit surprised because I have seen that many three-man rope teams in high up mountains only carry an MSR reactor with a 1.7-litre pot, like Tom Livingston and his partners during their Latok ascent. By the way, I love your book, blah, blah, blah. Best regards, Vincent. So this is kind of my reply. So, hi, Vincent. Thanks for your question. Rather than give you a tight and formalised answer, here is a bit of a brain splurge on stoves. So the first section is called Pasta Nazis. So this is where the Nazis come from. Snow melting is a subject a little like cooking pasta. Some people just throw the pasta into some cold water in a pan, crank up the heat and cook it until it looks cooked. While others, they will add the pasta to salted boiling water along with some olive oil, then remove it while it's al dente, add some more salt to season, and a tablespoon of olive oil, then serve. So you can tell, obviously you can tell that I'm a pasta Nazi because that is one of the things that is... I once was in Yosemite and Vanessa like cooked some pasta and basically she like put the pasta in the cold water and so it was spaghetti, so the spaghetti was sticking out of the water and then she, which is like, that's a travesty to begin with, it should be boiling water, but then she somehow managed to have the top half of the pasta not cooked and then the bottom half of the pasta, which was pressing on the bottom half of the pan, somehow got burnt or something. It was all stuck together. It was amazing. I think maybe my Pasta Nazism comes from going on expeditions and things where sometimes you have a very limited amount of food and often you have to carry that food in. So if you've carried in like a couple of kilos of food, if someone burns it or, you know, doesn't get the most out of it, it's not good. So you have to be a bit obsessive about, you know, like cooking rice and cooking pasta and cooking lentils. And like, it's horrible if you get like a freeze-dried meal and someone's put the water in, but they've not, they put the water in, the water wasn't hot enough. That's not good. It's not good if they don't put enough water in, or if they put too much water in, or if they've put the water in, but they haven't stirred it around properly. So you're eating your spaghetti bolognese, dehydrated spaghetti bolognese, and suddenly you get like a big mouthful of like dried cup of soup or something. It's like, yeah, it's pretty grim. That's why it's a good idea to always have like those long handled titanium spoons, you know, because you can get right down into the corners. Blah, blah, blah. Well, at the end of the day, both the imperfect and perfect methods give you a plate of pasta. Only one is perfect, the other less so. Only a pasta Nazi can tell. So it is with snow melting. You can be a snow melting Nazi and treat it like pasta, or does it really matter, Slack Harry? Both work and will produce water, but when the chips are down or the pasta, say you're on a thimble full of fuel left, or need to brew up that life-saving cup of tea below the summit of Everest, then being a Nazi might help. So I hope that's not offensive to any real Nazis out there. It's very rare to come across. I've never actually met a Nazi in my life, and must be out there. I did actually when I was growing up, and there was people who were into being Nazis, you know, who would like be into, I guess it was punk, it was a time of punk, so that was kind of a fashion thing. There was a, you know, there was that kind of punky thing. I think I was just about counterculture, isn't it? Like pushing against like the status quo. Like your parents and your grandparents fought the Nazis. So if you're a punk, then dressing up like a Nazi is, you know, that's the way to get them. It's a bit like is it Generation Z? What would that be? Like my daughter's a millennial. She was born like 1998, and my son's born 2001. Are they Gen Z? Anyway, whatever they are. But I think that generation is going to be like super conservative, super save all their money. They'll all be religious and all that kind of stuff. It'd be quite interesting to rebel against people who thought they were kind of rebelling. There was this guy, Barry Nuttall, and he was like, there was a lot of housing estates where I grew up, like old fashioned terrace housing, and then they knocked it all down because they thought it was like slum housing, because a lot of the houses had like outside toilets and stuff, and then they just kind of replaced them with the actual slum housing, which was broke up communities and moved them all over the place, and you know, a lot of people knew each other on these like terrace streets, and they just like, you know, just atomized them all. And so yeah, it's kind of this. But there was this guy, Barry Nuttall, and he was really into collecting army stuff. He must have been like in his 30s or something. He was like a grown up, an adult, and he had like a street. There was a street, and he had loads of like, he had a big like American army truck and all this kind of stuff. And what they did, he refused to leave his house, so he ended up having this like siege, and they ended up like knocking down all the houses around him, like a whole housing estate, you know, well, not an estate, but a whole like all these terrace houses, and they knocked them all down until it was like just his house was left behind, and there's a few like derelict, like, you know, half destroyed buildings, and we used to like go in there and like play around in the buildings and stuff. And and then eventually they actually somehow, whether the police got them out, but they actually knocked down his house. But instead of just giving in, he ended up like got a big tent, and he like put his tent up inside where his house had been, like in all these bricks and stuff. And they built like a, you know, it was like a prop. It was like something like a MASH or something. Anyway, so him and all these other people who were into the army or something, they all kind of camped out there for quite a long time. If you type in like Barry Nuttall, Hull, you'll find some stories about him, because he was I think he died like a few years ago, I think. But he was I don't know, that those things must like make an impression on you when you're a kid, is that like this person is basically getting fucked over by the council, and they knocked down his house, and he didn't want to go, and it's kind of must have an effect on you. But anyway, but he wasn't a Nazi. Like he was really into like American stuff. So anyway, the American stuff is much more cooler than being a Nazi, isn't it? You don't want to be a Nazi. So anyway, so back to the thing. So key points. The key points of snow melting is both the volume of snow to be converted back into water, per unit of fuel, in brackets fuel efficiency, and speed of production, in brackets time efficiency. For example, if you're sitting on a 100-gallon fuel drum at a base camp, you can just read to the end of your Dan Brown chapter as the water boils away, as neither fuel nor time efficiency is important, and stressing over a 60-second boil time difference or 5 milligrams of white gas versus 5 kilograms of kerosene is just another form of wastage. But if you're perched on a ledge in your sleeping bag in a winter storm, with just an egg cup of gas left in the canister, and every second spent cooking exposes you to the cold of the night, then your life might depend on seconds or milligrams of fuel. Somewhere between the two will be a three-person team at high camp resting before they get going to the summit, with rationed food and fuel, but who have to maximally hydrate. Added into these efficiencies are size and bulk and weight. Important if you only have a 30-litre pack, but less so with a Pulk or a Jeep, plus safety concerns about the process, blah, blah, blah. So I guess I'm saying there that, it, like, very, very often you get you, like, when you're sitting at home, say you're going to go and climb Denali, or you're going to climb Aconcagua or something like that, and you're Googling, like, how much fuel do I need? And people, like Americans, you know, they're like, oh, you need like a hand's worth or something, or like a sock of fuel. Or, you know, they always have these stupid, like a cup or three quarts or whatever. It's like, what the hell are you talking about? So anyway, so it's, so they get, so you, so, you know, you're really stressing over this amount of fuel. But unless you completely fuck it up, generally, you'll always have too much fuel. You know, if you're going, generally what people tell you is like the recommended amount is always generally more than you need. It's only if you're really trying to like shave it to the bone. You know, if you're trying to get like a canister of gas to last you like a whole week or something, then you're going to have to be like super, super on it, whatever, to, or you know, you've only got hardly any fuel left in your fuel bottle or something. It's like that. It's a bit like driving around in a car. Like, how many times you ever run out of petrol in a car? Like, you know, like 50 times. Like, I think I've run out of petrol twice in my whole life, you know, and it's kind of the same with the stove, but it's never very good when you, like, the stove's like, when it just, like, goes off. It's like, that's not very good. So it depends, like, what you're doing or whatever. So I would say, like, most of the time, I wouldn't. It's something that's, it's one of these things you stress about, but aren't really that important in the, when you get there. Because often if you're going to be away for a long time, you will generally have, like, so much fuel that, give or take, you know, 10 milligrams, 20 milligrams difference every day, you'll make it up anyway. So you'll always end up having some more. I know, like, when we went to Denali, when we were like stuck at the end, for like a week or something at the end, we just kind of ran the stove like all day long, like in the tent to stay warm, to be a bit warmer in the tent, and we still had fuel left at the end of it. So that's generally the case. Very rare that you run out. So the next section is the BTU trap. Very often people get sucked into the BTU trap. And BTU is British Thermal Unit. So BTU is like how much heat your stove gives out. Wherein they simply judge your stove by just its BTU score. As in, an MSR reactor, in brackets 9,000 BTU, must be better than a jet boil zip for 4,500 BTU, or that both are trumped by an MSR whisper light 9,500 BTU. You will find hundreds of YouTube videos, of people in their kitchens doing tests in which they boil a liter of water with X stove in order to prove it boils faster than Y. This is a mistake. Just as a Ford Mustang might appear to be better than a Ford Mondeo, when your aim is getting from A to B 5 days a week for the life of your car, why pick a car that increases your risk of dying fourfold, even if you get there a few minutes faster? Yes, it's easier to produce a very fast car, but for what you gain in speed, you might lose far more. And in brackets, in the case of a Mustang, that might be your life. I once was guiding somebody, and he had loads and loads of money, and he hired a Mustang, and it sounded like terrifying car, like just would just spin out, and it was just sort of badly balanced or whatever. It was a med or whatever, you know. It's surprised it didn't die. It actually nearly did die because he drove up to Yosemite. And he drove around the loop road in Yosemite the wrong way around. So he's driving up the road the wrong way around, in the wrong direction. And suddenly, like, a police car came around, or the ranger was coming the opposite way. And the ranger ended up, like, driving off the road into a tree. And luckily he took it quite well. So Mustangs, you know, a Stang, as I like to call it, you know. Just gonna get my Stang. Just avoid them. Put it another way, a Falcon space rocket produces 109 million BTUs. It's more than that. It's like 109,941,300,000. So it's like 109 million. 941, anyway, fucking loads. But it can't do it for long. Plus, it's crap at making a cup of tea. A humble Trangia, on the other hand, pumping out pedestrian 3,500 BTU will do so pretty much forever, as long as you keep adding spirits every hour. Is it half hour? Half an hour. God, this might be like a really boring podcast because it's just me. It's like BTUs. Anyway, and so it's best to see BTUs like you do the top speed of a car and work out if your thing is Formula One or driving from London to Cape Town. Generally, it's the latter. So I guess that's a good thing. It's good to apply that kind of thinking to a lot of things, because people will often get really, really obsessed about, this carabiner breaks at 8 kilonewtons, but this one breaks at, you know, whatever. But generally, people get so focused on these narrow kind of measurements of strength or whatever, is they often lose sight of other things. I once had this stove. It was like a Japanese stove someone gave me to try out. And it was massively powerful. Like, it would probably just melt your pan if you've got a pan on there. And also, it was apparently impossible for it to blow out, and it didn't need priming. I don't know how it did all these kind of things. But the problem was the actual pipe that connected the stove to the burner. You just screwed it on, and because of like the way a burner sits and the bottle sits on the other side, it would often just unscrew itself just through using it. And what would happen is I once was using it in my kitchen, and luckily I had it on a tray, on like a food tray, and suddenly the fuel was coming out of the bottle and it set on fire. So then the bottle and the tray and the stove, everything was all on fire. And my next door neighbour was putting out the washing, because we live in like a terraced house, so they were just putting out the washing. And they could see all these like flames coming, you know, through the window. And then I just opened the door and threw the stove out. So on paper, that stove was like probably one of the best camping stoves ever made. But it was you just die if you were using that inside a tent or something. You would just die. I think actually someone did not, when I did the troll, what went out to the troll wall, Tormud had one of those stoves. He was like sponsored by some company, and they gave him one of those stoves. And basically the same thing happened in the portal edge, like the stove was on fire. So yeah, being a portal edge with a stove that's on fire is much worse than just being in a tent, because you can't just jump out of can't jump out of a portal edge and like run away. You're just kind of trapped in there. So it wasn't good. I think I think his hands got set on fire or something. He had like gloves on. So he was okay. Tiered stoves. Before I go on, I'm going to break stoves down to three tiers, as to help you better understand how to get what you want. Tier 1 is a summit stove. Tier 2 is an advanced base camp mountain stove. Tier 3, static camping or base camp stoves. So I'll start with the tier 3 stoves, a base camp stove. I've lived in several places which had either single, double or quad gas rings hooked up to a large gas bottle, 4 kilo to 50 kilo propane bottle. This could be a standalone iron stand burner that was just about indestructible, or a tabletop kitchen burner, like a cooker minus the oven. So these are the kind of stoves you get in like Middle East, Africa, places like that. Like, I don't know, I'm sure people maybe have gas, but I don't think they actually have gas lines in a lot of these countries. So you're not going to be able to use electricity. Because like a lot of most countries, they have a lot of power cuts and things, which we'll be having no doubt soon. And so a lot of people don't, you know, they basically have lighting that works when there's no power. So they'll have like lanterns and candles and all that shit, paraffin lanterns and stuff. And then they'll have like a butane cooker. And this is a similar kind of thing. You'll see it like all over the place. This kind of stove is pretty much standard kitchen setup for the majority of people on the planet. Well, at least those who have progressed from wood or dung fires. Here in Ireland, a lot of people burn peat still, and you can pay. Like, some people have like a part of the bog that belongs to them. Like, it's been passed down through generations. Some communities have their own bit of bog, so you'd just be given a bit of bog. And you can also pay to have a bit of bog, and then you just go there. And basically, you go up with and you just cut the bog, and you pile it up, and then you sort of bring it home. You'll have to get a trailer, bring it home, and then you like let it dry out And it's quite effective. It's like, you know, it's like a very cheap way of heating your house and stuff. Because like Ireland was a pretty poor place for a long time. And people used to build houses out of it as well, out of the peat. They used to, if they got evicted, those nasty English people. They'd get evicted. They would like build a house out of peat, which is kind of interesting. So, in terms of utility and function, this kind of stove cannot be beaten. You can just turn on the rings with a match and easily turn the flame up and down to boil or simmer, with the gas lasting for months or years on end. They also work in power cuts. If you're a car camper, instead of taking along a jet boil or MSR, this is what you really want. So I don't know if you understand what I'm talking about. You can buy these stoves. The classic one is probably, it costs about like 50 to 70 quid, and it's like a big cast iron black thing with four legs, and it's got the burner in it, and you just have the pipe that comes off it, and it goes to usually like one of those like 4 kilo fuel bottles, which are, you know, like a big fuel bottle, like steel, iron, where it is, like, you know, like those red orange kind of things, and you just use that. It's what people use on like boats and stuff. If you see people like melting tar for doing like roadworks, they've got a similar kind of thing, and they're very good because they're basically indestructible, and they've got like a good you can actually fry an egg on it, you know, fried eggs, and boil large amounts of water as well, so they're good. So instead of using like a petrol stove is pretty good. But instead of using, like, if you're going car camping and that kind of stuff, you don't want to be using gas out of, you know, gas bottles, because it's just expensive for what it is. You just save that for other things. You're best with the petrol stove, and just use petrol from the petrol station, or like one of these kind of big things. And it's probably good, like, if you got your prepper head on, I think it's probably well worth everyone having in their houses some way of like cooking that's not connected to electricity. Anyway, such a stove will allow you to vary the BTUs like any kitchen stove, ranging from 400 for simmering to 1800 or even higher for specialist stoves, 2500 BTU. Most stoves, you can adjust them. You know, as you know, you can like simmer or get it quite hot. The burners on such stoves, not camping stoves, are also designed to handle medium to large to extra large pans, having much broader flame patterns. In brackets, they don't work well with little titanium camping mugs. This allows you to cook large meals for many people far more easily than juggling big pans on small camping stoves. So this is kind of important if you're going car camping, and say there's four of you, or you've got like, there's two families, you know, there's like eight people, kids and all that kind of stuff, is having that kind of stove is actually, you know, if you want to put enough pasta on for eight people, you're going to really struggle. Like with a normal camping stove, like if you, you know, Whisper Light, that kind of, like a jet boil, you can basically cook for two people. And you can't really cook, you know, unless you want to boil an egg. You basically can do stuff with water. Like, you don't want to be like cooking beans and shite. Pasta might be all right, but you basically don't want to putting food into a jet boil. It just wants to be water. But if you've got like a proper cooking stove for camping, like you can cook for four people. It's not too bad. You know, one pan with rice or something, and one pan with something else in, but beyond four, it gets kind of tricky. So those kind of bigger stoves are good. You can get like the multi-burner stoves, which either use gas or fuel, and they're kind of good. But really, for the price of those stoves, you're kind of better just getting like one of these like industrial kind of stoves, really. Such stoves allow enough room to be boiling water on one ring while running a large wok or frying pan on the other. They're also dirt cheap because the customer base is skint. In brackets, that's why Aga cookers cost the same as a car. This means it's possible to run multiple burners at a low cost. In brackets, you can buy a single cast iron burner unit for about $50 or even cheaper. So they're the kind of things you probably get in a classic kind of base camp. If you like go on a trip and you employ someone to bring up to come up to base camp as a cook, that's probably the kind of stove they're gonna use, really, like one of these big things. Although this style of stove is not going to be carried in a pack, it's the ideal heavy-duty base camp stove, with its multi-burner being perfect for both melting snow or large pans, 10 litres plus, but also maintaining a rolling boil or simmer, although generally you would transfer water into a large flask. So if you're running a base camp kitchen, cooking and melting snow for dozens of people, this is the kind of stove you'll use. Not a dozen jet boils, as you will really not have to think hard about either speed or fuel efficiency, as long as you're sensible. So the classic, you know, if you're ever going to a hut, alpine hut, in, you know, this is kind of stove like they'll have in huts basically, and they usually have like a giant aluminium pan, like 10 liters, you know, 15 liters, where you just keep putting snow in it and just running the flame and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, it's classic. So anyway, a tier two stove, in brackets ABC stove, so advanced base camp stove. So you see there are some great things about tier three setups, but that's not the kind of trip you're going on. You're not going to take such a system on a plane, in brackets, but rather buy or rent in country, or carry it on your back, but rather get dropped off with it, in brackets, or carry it in a vehicle. Yes, you'll be camping and will be out in the wild for an extended period, so not survival alpine style cooking, but you need a portable option, and yet you still want to have some tier 3 functionality, such as be able to bring along a multi-week month supply of food, cook with both small and large pans, and both cook complex and simple meals, plus melt snow. When working through your options for such a trip, you should always nail redundancy first, because although a broken jet boil might force a sad retreat down a climb, a broken stove, when it's the only one you have, on a remote glacier far from rescue, that'd be far more serious. In brackets, you'll end up having to burn your ropes to melt snow to survive until pickup. This means you will need a two-stove system at a minimum for a two-person team, or one stove per two people, in brackets. So two or four-person team would have two stoves, while a six-person team would have three. Don't forget that having two stoves does not mean you don't need to look after them as you would. In brackets, I know how to do that, meaning you need a repair kit, spares, at least one spare pump, and multiple fuel bottles. In brackets, if you stand on your only fuel bottle with your crampons on, you've had it. Someone told me a story about some really famous Austrian speed climbing famous guy who got dropped off at the backside of Denali. He was going to do like a speed ascent of some route on Denali, the Cassin or whatever. And then a few hours later, he like called them up and he said, "Oh, you have to come and pick me up again." And basically, he didn't know his stove worked, so he must have never used like an MSR stove, which I guess that's what he would have had. He didn't know how to get it to work, so he obviously didn't know you had to prime it, I guess, so he kept like switching it off and just all the fuel would be coming out and stuff, which is kind of disturbing. But it's very important to learn how to use a stove. To if you got a petrol stove, know how to prime it. You kind of need to know how dangerous petrol is. It's very, very dangerous. It's just dangerous, like if you spill it, like it really doesn't, it lights very easily if you're spilling it anywhere. You know, got to be careful when you're filling your fuel bottles up and all that kind of stuff. I guess you got to be careful with all these things. Next is fuel. You do not want to use gas cartridges for a tier one stove. I meant to say tier two stove, due to both bulk and cost, as well as steadiness, meaning a liquid fuel, i.e. either white gas or petrol, is your best and only option. With all liquid stoves, you need a method of carrying gas that is 100% leak-proof and robust, especially if you're going to abuse your containers physically or environmentally. Note that the plastic gets fragile in the cold and can shatter. Also, remember that most fuel containers are designed to hold fuel on a shelf, not inside a pack or bulk. Now, a good demonstration of this is a friend of mine who was skiing to the North Pole, and he must have spent, you know, 100 grand to do this trip, and he was going solo. And I think on like day three, he just had his fuel in these like big plastic containers that it came with from the shop. And what happened was one of them just broke in the cold, because it's very cold, and the fuel went everywhere, and it contaminated all his food, and it was like game over basically. So not good. And I've done it myself you have to be careful. As a side note, the British lost about 25% of all their fuel during the North African desert wars during World War II due to using poor quality fuel containers made from tin, which were poorly designed, being only single use. The problem was only partially remedied by adopting captured multi-use German jerry cans. So jerry can is like an amazing bit of design. Things like it's a proper one has like three handles. So it means that the middle handle is for carrying by one person, and then the two outside handles for carrying by two people. And it's got depressions on it, so if it gets really hot, they will like pop out rather than the thing kind of, you know, like bursting or whatever. And you know, they're designed to like stack up. And like the British jerry cans, well, the British fuel cans are basically a little bit like a big square box, but they were just made out of tin, so they weren't very strong. So you couldn't, if you stacked too many on top of each other, they would just crush the bottom ones. And so yeah, so it's good. It's a good thing to keep in mind if you're going on a trip and you're carrying, you know, if you're bringing a lot of fuel with you, because it's very easy for the fuel to get ruined and stuff. Personally, I think it's best to bite the bullet and carry all fuel in MSR fuel bottles. In brackets, I own about 27. As this pretty much guarantees fuel security, but also removes the problem of filling bottles. If you're filling bottles, then make sure you take along a funnel, ideally one with a filter, as this will stop rust and cockroaches getting into your bottles. In brackets, also never place your fuel anywhere near your food. So if you're buying, generally petrol is probably better than it used to be if you're buying petrol. But you do have to be careful. Like some places, you could be getting very poor quality petrol. You know, they might have been sitting in a tank for a long time, or they might just see you coming along and say, I will give this person this, some, like, you know, it's got rust in it and crap in it. So it's a good idea to like try and filter out your fuel if you're in doubt. Like if you're getting bottles of, you know, white gas or whatever, and it's good, it looks like good quality, then you'll be fine. If fuel bottles are not an option, then small or even large fuel containers for cars, orange plastic 5-litre ones or 20-litre metal jerry cans work, note that the more fuel you carry in a single container, the more fuel you'll lose if something happens to it, i.e. stolen, falls over the lid off, gets contaminated, etc. So that's a good, that is kind of a good point. The expedition default these days is generally the MSR Whisperlite or XGK. I put the XGK2, but it's actually called the XGK something else now, stove. But my personal choice would be the Whisperlite due to it being much easier on the ears and has the ability to simmer. In brackets, I would add in a simmer ring as well. Some people will say the XGK is a better expedition stove, but I've used the Whisperlite until it was stolen pretty much every day for about 2 years, from minus 50 to plus 50, sea level to 17,000 feet, and it never let me down once. Note, in super cold temperatures, you need to sleep with the fuel pumps to avoid fuel leaking out, which will also affect the XGK. So a few things there. So yeah, so there are other stoves. There's like primer stoves and other stoves out there. I just think the Whisperlite just seems to be like the stove a lot of people have. If you go to most climbing shops, if they sell stoves, they'll have, usually have loads of crappy sort of gas stoves, those bluet stoves and stuff, but the whisper light ones are very common everywhere in the world. And they're just very, they're just a very methodical, improved design over a long period. They're kind of robust and they kind of work. Generally, I think the people who like struggle to get the stoves to work, there's all sorts of reasons. Like this, like even like this, even if the stove is really dirty, it'll generally, it's generally going to work, but it might be they've got, the fuel is contaminated, it's got water in it. Like I seem to think that if you somehow get water in it, like if you get snow in the bottle or something, then that can kind of block it up a little bit, maybe. And most of the problems, I'd say all the problems are going to happen with the pump, because the pump is, you know, it's, that's got the most parts in it. It's things like the, you might not be able to get enough pressure. Like if the little cup inside the thing is, gets deformed or damaged or it freezes, then, you know, you might not be able to get that to get enough pressure. But that's just a case of lubricating it or having a right kind of cup. You also get like two different types. You get like a super cold extreme pump, and you get like a standard pump. And what the inside the pump, you've got lots of little rubber washers and gaskets and stuff. And if you're at like minus 50 or something, they'll, a bit like the space shuttle, you know, the blew up, like they'll just stop working. And what will happen is the fuel will start leaking out of the stove, which can cause like a fire if you're, you know, and it'll lose, probably lose pressure as well. So that's why it's a good idea to like have the pump with you inside your clothes, but only if it's super super cold. Like if it's just minus 20 or whatever, it doesn't really, I don't think it really matters, but it's like only if it's like mega 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 cold. And yeah, and you always want to carry, another one was a woman who was going to ski to the North Pole, and she said that even that she was just camping in before she was setting off, and she said all her pumps broke, and I'm not quite sure if that's true or if she just like smashed them all, she didn't have to go. But that was you know, it's good. Did they break? Have you ever broken a pump? You're probably going to break a pump when you're trying to take it to pieces, and you're not doing it right. Like you don't really understand how to take it to pieces. So it's just one of these things. The longer you have whatever stove you got, the longer you have it, the more you'll understand how much to prime it and how much to do all that kind of stuff. Like generally, I tend to, if it's like a serious kind of trip where weight's not really, really a big problem, I tend to take like methylated spirits, and I use like methylated spirits to prime the stove because it's a lot cleaner. Like if you're in a snow hole and you're like, you know, you get a lot of soot off when you're priming a stove. So it's just cleaner to have like a bottle of methylated spirits and just squirt a bit of that on it and heat the stove up. So such a two-stove system can be used to set up a great base camp kitchen when used in conjunction with a wooden cooking board, and both stoves can be used together under a large pan if speed is crucial. This might be important in a large team. So that basically means you just have two stoves underneath one pan, so you're like doubling the speed. I've got some quite big pans. I've also got like a big kettle, big aluminium kettle that's kind of good, but it's just a funny shape. Like you carry it in a pulk, you won't carry it anywhere else. But that's quite good if you're filling up flasks. If you've got a kettle, if you're filling up flasks or filling up food sachets for dehydrated food and stuff. But it's not very easy to put. It's not as easy to put snow into it because of the. It's like a kettle. It hasn't got like a really huge lid at the top, so it's, you know, got to take your, you know, pros and cons. When weight becomes a factor, you can take one stove and have the advantage of not having to stress about cold or loss of pressure. Such a stove is also much improved both in pan stability and fuel efficiency, but most of all CO2 avoidance. If you build a windshield pan support think Trangia setup. So basically what I'm saying there is, if you're using like a petrol stove, they're generally a lot tougher than like a gas stove. Like if you get some sort of mountain marathon, super duper, you know, 2 gram titanium stove, gas stove that fits on a gas canister, they're generally a lot, you know, not as robust. And my MSR XGK, some smart aleck in Alaska probably, or somewhere where I was traveling through an airport, they got it out. They must have got it out of my bag, and they basically hammered it flat with a hammer. Because basically when I got it out, instead of being like an XGK, it was just flat, a flat XGK. But the thing is, it still worked, even though it had been hammered. So there's that thing that, was it the drop test, you know, can you get a stove and throw it 40 foot into the air and land on concrete and will it still work? So that's kind of important. And I think I've mentioned before, like I built like a windshield that elevates, it's like made out of aluminium, so very thin aluminium. It's like thicker than, it's solid aluminium. It's not like, you know, like tinfoil aluminium like you get on a windshield, like an MSI windshield. And that's designed to elevate the pan. Or you can either have it a normal windshield, so the pan is sitting on top of the stove, but you can also have it so the pan is like 5 centimeters above where it should be, and that stops carbon monoxide like building up carbon dioxide, one of those carbon things. As for pan size, all such stoves are limited by the size of the flame. In a very large pan, 10 litres, will only work when used with two stoves. Make sure the setup is stable. And so I would not use a pan larger than 2.5 litres or 20 centimetres wide, as you will begin to lose efficiency. So yeah, so you don't, it's okay if you're in like a mountain hut and you've got this big burner and you can put a huge big pan on it. But generally for standard, you know, standard cooking for like two people, you'd be better just using that 2.5 litre pan and, you know, doing two boils rather than having a 5 litre pan and trying to melt all the snow and make enough, you know, for just doing it, you know, just doing it once. One last point on is fuel consumption, of which there is a lot of conflicting advice. The amount you need to carry depends on many factors, including the obvious, assuming you're looking at milligrams per person, such as altitude, temperature, in brackets, do you get your water from a tap or a stream or from snow or ice, and type of food you're cooking, in brackets, fresh or dried, pasta or brown rice. But you also need to ask if your consumption is casual or calculated, as it's easy to spend a rest day brewing up endless cups of tea and fried egg sandwiches and use a litre of gas, while on a route you get away with just a tenth of that. As a baseline for calculating summer use, I would go with 120 millilitres of white gas and 200 millilitres for a winter expedition, if it's casual. So that's per person. If it's casual, it doesn't matter, as you'll no doubt be near a gas station. This 200 milliliter figure can be reduced by maybe 30% if you use a high quality windshield, heat exchanger, reflective stove board, and employ a single boil strategy. In brackets, you only run the stove once a day and employ your flasks for drinking for breakfast drinks. Yeah, so that I think that's like a Norwegian technique, is you only put the stove on once. There's no like getting up at like the crack of dawn and trying to get your stove going in the coldest time of the day and trying to, you know, brew up and getting cold fingers. You just, in the evening, you just do all your water for the next day. So you can put water in algae in bottles, you put water in flasks, and you use the water in the flask in the morning. And I generally try and have cold cereal, because it's just easier to have cold cereal. So that's what I tend to do, because you're just saving fuel really, rather than like heating up the thing. As for snow melting, if you're using a 10 litre pan filled with snow versus a 2.5 litre pan, you may well find that the 10 litre pan is easier and less time consuming for you to monitor. Just keep adding in snow and allow it to melt. But in terms of fuel and time efficiency, carefully monitoring a 2.5 litre pan will be better. This will be doubly so if you also want to melt the snow and boil it. And I think it would be far faster to do this four times with a 2.5 litre pan than once with a 10 litre pan, because high volumes of water on medium BTU stoves will often reach some equilibrium where the water is cooling faster than it can heat up. In brackets, add a second stove and you might move this point. On the subject of melting snow, one of the most important points is to make sure that your snow melting water boiling pan should never be used for cooking. Doing so will introduce food particles that will contaminate your water and make it taste foul. This is most common when someone just fills a pan up to the top with snow and just sticks it on a high flame. What happens is the snow in contact with the base of the pan melts and then partly evaporates, leaving bare metal that superheats and burns any food particles, making the water undrinkable. Contaminants also include coffee, tea, or sports drink. Separate out your cooking pans from your water pan. So I'm sure that kind of makes sense to anybody. If you're just summer camping, you know, it doesn't matter. You can cook pasta and then cook a cup of tea, or do some beans and then cook a cup of tea once you've cleaned it. But if you're on like a winter trip, you know, everything. It's all basically water based what you're doing. So you just don't want to be like it's like really foul if you get water that gets burnt water, which can happen. So now onto the final tier one stoves, summit stoves. These will generally be a single stove unless you're concerned about having to bivy apart. In brackets, the weight of the burner on a jet boil stove is minimal if each climber is using the pan. It's part of their personal mug pan. So that just means, you know, instead of having one jet boil, you just have like two jet boils. And, you know, you'd probably have two gas canisters if you had one jet boil. So this just means, you know, you just, one person's got one canister, you've got the other canister, and, you know, you just have the stove part. And you're just going to replace, each person's got the pan and the burner. So it's a little bit heavier, but it kind of... You know, if you wanted to hydrate quicker, that system would probably be a very good way of doing it, because for a minimal extra bit of weight, you'd like double the time. It would, you know, half the time it would take to melt snow and hydrate and stuff. Someone told me that when in the Marines, I don't know if it's the same in like other, I guess it's the same in all sorts of armies, but everyone has loads of people have a jet boil now in like a pouch, and if someone says, you know, like 5 minute stop, like you'll just hear all these jet boils firing up and everyone making a cup of tea and stuff. So it's a good, you know, it'd be good if you're doing like a big snowy route, instead of carrying, you know, trying to bring loads of water up there, it's gonna freeze and it'd be useless. You know, it's quite good to do the it's quite good. I hear my son outside the door panting around. It's quite good to, to have like your one stove each, because it's good. If you're in like a survival situation, you know, having a stove makes a huge difference. God, I hear my son, he's trying to get the door open. Like a little rat. He's like, nye-nye. Go away! It's good to be cruel to them. Oh, God. Noah! Oh, he knows I'm in here. Can hear me. I shouldn't have shouted. You can let him in. You can be on the podcast. Oh, Christ almighty. I'm in the middle of doing my podcast. You don't understand what I'm talking about, do you? God, you need to grow up. You need to grow up, boy. God. Ow! God, he's grabbing my balls. Stop. Christ almighty. This is not... You don't get...
I'll take him. Come on, you.
This is not professional. This is not professional.
Whatever.
Anyway. what's the other bit? And can be a canister or liquid fuel, depending on the length and consequence of failure. In brackets, a canister stove has a higher failure rate, and most faults can be fixed in the field. Yeah, if you got a canister stove, the only thing you can basically take is a pricker for pricking the nozzle if it gets somehow some dirt gets in there, which does happen. But apart from that, where a petrol stove, it's amazing how you can bring one back to life somehow. You know, they're a little bit like a two-stroke engine or something. Like they're very, very simple devices. You know, you just, the fuel basically, you have a thing that stops the fuel coming out. You have a thing that pressurizes the bottle. And then when you open the fuel, you know, like it has to be heated to vaporize the fuel. Then it, so it's very good. But some, you know, there were like the peak stoves were bloody terrible. Like they have a lot of problems with those, but you know, the newer ones, that's why NextGK is kind of good, because it's very, it's even more simple. It hasn't got a fuel line. It's just got like a metal fuel line. Oh, no, it has got a fuel line now. It doesn't have a metal, it used to have a metal fuel line. So I don't know. I'm not sure when you would use that. Maybe if you were going to use like lots of like diesel and kerosene, anyway, all that other stuff. But you generally, if you can get petrol, you get petrol everywhere. Here it's important to focus on this one pan system, and keep your pan, you will generally only have one, only for water. Adding this into a cup of dehydrated food bags. I don't know what that means. You're just gonna have one pan when you're climbing, when you're actually climbing, and you're just gonna use that for melting water, and you're gonna put that into another cup, like your drinking cup or your food cup, or you're gonna put it into something else. And I've just said how those, like the plastic containers, plastic wrap packets that you get dehydrated food in, they actually make quite good bowls for eating out of. Just clean one out and just carry it, because you can, you know, carry that pretty well. You roll it up so you haven't got like a big... That's a problem with like cups, they're kind of bulky. So, my MSR reactor stove, inside it I have like a titanium cup, Alpkit one, that fits inside the stove. Then inside that goes a GSI plastic cup. So the whole... So it's quite good. You've got all your cups and all your bowls inside the stove. So that works really, really well. And I have it like in a bag as well. I sewed up a bag, so the whole thing goes inside a bag. Because you don't want to be, if you're on like a ledge or if you're on a big wall or something, you don't want to be getting out all your stove stuff, and the lid falls off and you lose it, and then the burner falls out. You want everything to be inside one container. A great story to illustrate this point was Colin Haley's solo of Mount Hunter. Being very thirsty and dehydrated with just a little gas left, he stuffed his jet boil stove with snow and just cranked it up and waited for it to boil. Unbeknownst to Colin, the remnants of his last meal in the pan just turned to carbon, creating a foul-tasting and undrinkable slush, meaning he was not only out of gas and water, but also had a mouthful of foul poison. In brackets, this is typically... reality of doing a Bear Grylls and drinking your own piss. So yeah, I had a friend who he took like a 70 meter fall on the Grand Jurass, and he broke his ankle, like shattered his ankle, and he broke his hip, broke his pelvis, and he was kind of left on the mountain, tied onto the mountain, while there was four of them. And the other three people tried to climb to the summit to try and get a rescue for him. And he ended up being left there for maybe like 3 days or something, 3 nights. And he was absolutely like on his last legs, and he was really dehydrated. And he'd pissed because he was in his sleeping bag, like tied to the side of the face. he'd pissed into his Nalgene bottle, and he decided he was going to drink the piss. He was so thirsty, and when he drank the piss, it was like sulfuric acid. And he said, like, you know, 1 minute he was in like the most pain he'd ever been in his life, and next minute he was in like doubly bad pain. So yeah, don't drink your piss unless you don't want to drink your piss. If you're not really that bothered about drinking your piss, then you can drink your piss. But if you really, really want to drink your piss, then probably don't drink your piss. Unless you saved your piss when you weren't really that bothered, you know, maybe that's a good thing, like, you know, just, you know, money in the bank kind of thing. So tier one strategy. Really, your question here is about using a tier one stove in a tier one style stove scenario. And most climbs, when you're using a tier one stove, you will only have a small pan, depending on the team size, and limited fuel. And so it's best to do the following. When melting snow, try and get set up so everything is where you need it, as this will limit the chance of spilling all your hard-earned water. In a camp setting, this means having a bag for snow, an IKEA carry bag works, or a stuff sack, good for high camp. Plus, it's good to have something clean to scoop in the snow, like a mug or jug. Okay. Many plastic cups and jugs will break in the cold, and so a Lexan-style cup mug works best. So is that kind of obvious what I'm talking about? You just want something else to scoop the snow in. This is mainly base camp stuff. It's not necessarily high up when you're climbing. It's best to avoid just scooping snow up around you, as this can easily contain all sorts of nastiness as people move around. So a good example of this was when we tried to do the Russian route on the north face of the Eiger. We had like a camp under a big overhang, and I think we were there for maybe 3 nights as we were like fixing. We're doing like kind of going capsule style. It means that you fix your ropes up, and then you like haul everything up, and then you fix your ropes up and you haul everything up. So it means you get like a really good camp. Like we had some amazing camps on that climb. We had one, it was like in a snow hole, like underneath the overhang. We had amazing camps, great camping holiday. Anyway, so, but one night, because we were like in the same place for a long time, you're just kind of reaching out of the front of the tent and like getting some snow and then melting it in our reactor. Then one day, like Neil Charlton, he's like eating his dehydrated food. He's like, "What's this?" And he pulls out this massive toenail. And basically, I think it was my toenail. I think I'd like cut my toenail and like flicked it out the door of the tent, and it just landed in the snow. And then I'd scooped it up. So, but that's not too serious. Like, but if you get someone having a shit and then walking back in, and they've got shit on the shoes, and it ends up in the snow, you know, you'll get like gastroenteritis or something. It could kill you. So yes, it's good to, I think, you know, it's good to, like, if you're getting snow, get, you know, make sure you, like, if you're gonna piss and shit, go on this side of the tent, you know, and get all your snow from the other side of the tent. Like, don't, you know, really kind of, these things are kind of important, and the longer you're away for, the more important they become. Try and always begin snow melting by priming the job with water. This can be done with the remains of your day's water ration, in brackets, not if you're using a sports drink. An alternative system that will not work for alpine climbing, but rather polar trips, is to employ a flask and always leave a little bit in the bottom to start the snow melting. This priming water will avoid the possibility of a pan heating up and burning, as well as generally making the job easier. I'm sure that's kind of self-explanatory, isn't it? So if you're using priming water or snow, I think it's best to start with a few centimetres of cold water that could be heated to the start of a boil, and then keep adding in the snow, which will constantly turn into water, and then cooling the hot water as it does so. So you just want to keep adding the snow so it's like opaque. You don't want to add it until it ends up being like a big white lump of snow, because this basically, when you add snow to the water, the snow will like absorb the water, so you'll end up with like a big like wet snowball, and then they're all around it, the pan will get really, really hot. So you just need to just keep adding it so it stays liquid. Now, if you're trying to fill up your Nalgene bottles, when you get maybe 100%, 120% of the water needed boiling, if you want it to use it as a hot water bottle in the night, or cold if you want to save fuel, transfer it over to the bottle, leaving behind that 20%, which will then be the primer for the next batch of water. This approach will be much faster than trying to melt and heat 2 liters of water, emptying the pan and starting again. If you're adding boiling water to food bags, again, cook 120% of what you need, add the water, and then melt more water while the food is heating up. Place it inside the clothes for extra heat, and invest in a large plastic WeLock bag clip to avoid spills. So a WeLock bag clip is, do you know those, like, it's like a plastic clip that you can put on cereal or whatever, and it clicks on. Like you can get like a long one which you can put on a bag when otherwise, if you you gotta leave it 5 minutes to cook, and if you put that inside your sleeping bag or inside your coat, invariably you're gonna like forget it's there, like lean over and splodge it all over inside everything, which is very messy. If you're using a jug for doing the putting the snow in, that can be kind of handy for decant some water into it and then pour it into your food container. You just want to like it. If you put the boiling water into that cup, and the cup is cold, you're going to lose some of the heat out of it. So generally, you want to like just kind of like warm it up. If you're really obsessive about this thing, warm up the cup, the jug before you pour the water in, and then pour it straight into the thing. And you can also then you can also measure it, so you know exactly how much water is going in. So you don't want to put too much in. You definitely don't want to put too little in. You're always best putting it too much in, really. Number six, it's always faster to melt ice than snow. And so if you're just about finished your stove duty, try and end up with a little bit of ice in the pan, as this will speed things up in the morning if you don't have any priming water. So it's all very obvious, really, isn't it, about how these things work, really. Wilderness factors. The most fuel-efficient approach in a wilderness setting has to be weighed against a number of factors, some environmental, some practical, maybe even cost. This includes altitude, temperature, weight, bulk allowance, access to fuels, safety, both CO2 and fire. A good quality gas stove with a brand new canister of gas at sea level on a summer's day will rapidly burn a bag of ice cubes into several cups of tea. And anyone testing such a stove before a trip to climb the Cassin Ridge will no doubt be assured their ability to produce life-giving liquid to the team, both to hydrate bodies and food. Now, once you get to 14,000 feet with a half full gas canister, your last, with temperature below minus 20, your integral spark are broken and all your lighters wet, you may find you're struggling to even produce cold water. If you're lucky, you might be experienced enough to be cooking in a warmer part of the day, have a flint and steel, and use a reactor or jet boil stove that is highly efficient, and employing a heat exchanger to counteract the cold, in brackets, or simply putting your hands around the canister. So a heat exchanger, if you don't know what it is, you just put like something that goes through the flame and then goes back onto the canister and like heats the thing up. An alternative to the summer sea level test will be running an MSR Whisperlite with a full fuel bottle of white gas. As above, you'd rapidly turn your ice cubes into tea. Saying that, this setup would no doubt lose points due to an MSR stove being a bit heavier and bulkier and more expensive, in brackets, due to having to deal with raw fuel, which is preheated, etc., rather than compressed gas, and dirty. Plus, it's not just a foolproof push-and-go option. It requires priming, and in brackets, it requires a certain level of skill to use safely and effectively. But transfer that stove to 14,000 feet, half a bottle of fuel, and cold temps, and how does it perform? Well, just the same as it did in your kitchen. The difference here, perhaps, while perched on a tiny ledge, is which stove, irrespective of efficiency, has the greatest ability, irrespective of speed or fuel efficiency. I know of people who've used a jet boil inside their sleeping bag, something you can't do with an XGK. Sure, the liquid stove might produce a pan of boiling water, but priming it while it's sat on your knees and balancing a pan on top requires a lot more skill than just firing up a reactor. So that I've had to do that, where you basically got your stove board, and it's on your knee, and you're trying to like get your XGK type stove going, which is not easy. Like the ability to use a lot of the proper stoves as a hanging stove makes a massive difference, especially if you're in a tent. Like knocking over your pan in a tent is a disaster, especially if you spill loads of water on your sleeping bags or whatever. So the ability to have a hanging stove, even with a reactor thing, it just makes a huge difference, really. Especially if you've got like a bivy tent, because they're not very big, and it makes a big difference. Also, when you elevate your stove high up in the tent, like all the heat coming off the stove basically is trapped, because the heat rises, it goes in the top of the tent, and that creates a slightly better environment for the gas to work better. A note on cold, hot and boiling water. A unit of gas or petrol will produce 10 times more cold water than boiling, and about 5 times as much hot water. A unit of gas will produce 10 times more cold water than boiling, and about 5 times. This is an important point when you're in a survival or fuel rationing scenario, as cold water has just as many calories as boiling. When boiling water is the only acceptable end product, where boiling water is the only acceptable end product is when heating dried food. Although even here, you can soak dried food overnight in cold water in an emergency. You can also stuff the bag with snow and place it inside your clothing while on the move, or in a sleeping bag. Foregoing hot drinks can be tough on your team morale, but if it's only for one night or two, it's far better than the alternative, which is a deep and debilitating thirst, in brackets, made all the worse by being surrounded by water. So yes, so that's the end of this. I think I should have done like a little bit of a conclusion there. I think I was like writing this in bits and rewriting it, and I forgot to do a conclusion. So there you go. Like, I don't know if anyone has any thoughts on that, if it was like really, really boring, but it's a key topic if you're doing any kind of expedition malarkey. So I should say again, if anyone wants to do any just do a little review, feedback on the iTunes, that'd be much appreciated. I need to try and get my iTunes things up, because you get a higher ranking. These things matter a lot to me. And if you do, just email me and I'll send you a PDF of my driven peg thing I wrote a long time ago. And hopefully I'll get Pete on the podcast soon. So I think I'll be traveling on Friday over to the UK on the ferry. So I'll try and interview Pete, talk to Pete this week. Pete when it was on the Troll Wall recently, so he's made a little film about the Troll Wall, so we're going to talk about that. And also he's going to be on tour as well, so we'll talk about his tour kind of stuff. If anybody's going to come and see me on tour in the UK, all the details are on, if you'd look up, like, you look on my website, but also Speakers from the Edge. And although I don't do social media, it'd be great if anybody wants to share any of the links to that tour to anybody who might come along. Like, it's a tough time for theatres, tough time for comedians and performing people. So there's a lot of people looking at all the links for the tour, but seems to be more hesitant about buying tickets. So I think people are always, yeah, we need to get people out and about, back to, you know, back to normality. Okay, that's it. Next time, until next time. Hopefully, I'm going to go and chastise my son now, my wife, for like the humiliation of having him coming here grabbing my balls as I'm doing my thing. And he's just at the right height for like pulling himself up by grabbing my balls. So anyway, that's it. Until next time.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.